This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
It's 6 a.m. in Shanghai, 9 a.m. in Sydney, and 6 p.m. here in New York. I'm Julia Chastley, and wherever you are in the world, this is your First Move. And well, welcome to First Move, as always, and here's today's Need to Know. Growing international outrage after seven World Central Kitchen aid workers were killed by an Israeli airstrike in Gaza. Tackling tensions, US President Biden and Chinese President Xi Jinping speak for the first time since November last year. Tesla's wrong turn, car deliveries disappoint, and annual sales drop for the first time since the pandemic. And firmly arm in arm with the biggest AI players in the world. The CEO of Arm Holdings will discuss chip competition, geopolitical tensions, and what the AI future holds. That conversation and plenty more coming up. But first, the international community is condemning an Israeli strike that has killed at least seven workers from World Central Kitchen. The British Prime Minister calling the situation in Gaza, quote, increasingly intolerable. France, the UAE and Cyprus are also speaking out. The White House says it wants accountability.
We were outraged to learn of an IDF strike that killed a number of civilian humanitarian workers yesterday from the World Central Kitchen, which has been relentless in working to get food to those who are hungry in Gaza and, quite frankly, around the world. We send our deepest condolences to their families and loved ones.
The victims include people from the United Kingdom, Poland, Australia, a Palestinian and a dual American-Canadian citizen. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel called the strike unfortunate and unintentional. The charity's founder, meanwhile, Chef José Andrés, is now calling on the Israeli government to, quote, stop this indiscriminate killing. World Central Kitchen has now also paused its aid efforts. It's even debating its future there. Melissa Bell has more.
Hey, this is Omi and Chef Olivier. We're at the Djerba Lav kitchen, and we've got the mise en place.
Smiling in one of her final moments, Zomi Francom, an Australian aid worker, one of the seven World Central Kitchen employees killed by an Israeli airstrike as they delivered food to a warehouse in central Gaza. A dual US-Canada citizen, UK nationals, a Polish man and a Palestinian also amongst those killed. The hum of war drones drowning out the sound of ambulance sirens as their bodies were brought to hospital after the strike, but too late. All trying to bring relief to the more than 1 million Gazans the UN says are now facing famine, all now in body bags. The logo of the aid organization, a reminder of the lengths the charity went to protect its own. Traveling as they were, according to the World Central Kitchen, through a deconflicted zone whilst coordinating their movements with the IDF. The charity, which was central in getting around the blockade by getting the first maritime shipment of aid into Gaza, now saying that it needs to assess its future in the Strip. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu acknowledged the tragic loss of what he described as innocent lives.
Unfortunately, in the last day, there was a tragic case of our forces unintentionally hitting innocent people in the Gaza Strip. It happens in war. We will investigate it right to the end.
So far, at least 196 aid workers have lost their lives in the occupied territories since the start of the war, according to the UN agency tasked with relief there. The World Central Kitchen workers just the latest. Among them, the Palestinian driver and translator Saif Issam Abu Taha. His loved ones forced to say goodbye to a man who died trying to help others to survive. Melissa Bell, CNN, Jerusalem.
Meanwhile, Iran promising to retaliate following Monday's attack on a consulate building in Damascus, where at least seven officials were killed. Here's the Iranian ambassador to Syria.
There is, of course, an international responsibility towards this crime, and naturally, there will be an Iranian response. We are waiting for international organizations to do their duty. We ask the United Nations and the Security Council to hold a meeting tonight in the Security Council, and we are waiting for all member countries to do their duties towards this crime during this meeting.
And hours ago, the Pentagon confirmed it believes Israel did carry out the strike. It also said it was given no prior warning of the attack. Ben Weidman has more on this story from Beirut for us. Ben, what would Iran consider a proportional and appropriate response in this vein that doesn't take what's always been a sort of shadow war fought via proxies and allow it to spill into the open at a very delicate moment, another delicate moment?
I think that's the question that many people are asking. The feeling is that the Israelis are sort of going further and deeper in terms of striking their enemies in Lebanon, for instance, and Syria as well. Keep in mind, for instance, in the early hours of this Friday, there was an Israeli strike. There's no question about that, really, despite their denial or their hesitance to claim responsibility on a facility outside of Aleppo, northern Syria, that left nearly 40 soldiers dead, some of them Hezbollah fighters. What we're seeing is that the Israelis are increasingly striking targets, high-profile targets like these senior IRGC officials in Damascus. And, of course, the Iranians have vowed to respond. The question is, how are they going to do it? Until now, what they have done is worked through their various allied militias, Hezbollah here in Lebanon, militias in Iraq and in Syria, the Houthis in Yemen. They have always been hesitant to directly strike either the Israelis or, of course, the Americans, who the Iranians and many in the region consider to be partners of the Israelis. But the thing is that at this point, Iran's profile, its deterrent power is on the line. And if it does not respond forcefully and strongly to this Israeli strike, it will be seen as weak by both friend and foe. On the other hand, if it does strike Israel somehow directly or the United States, this could indeed ignite a wider regional war. Julia?
Clearly, Ben, and that's the danger that all sides, including Israeli allies, are facing at this moment. Can you just frame that in light of what we've seen in the past 24 hours with the British Prime Minister calling the situation in Gaza increasingly intolerable, the outrage that's being expressed in various quarters by the deaths of those aid workers in Gaza? It just further ratchets up the pressure on Israel to agree to some kind of temporary pause, if only because this further suspends the ability to provide aid to Palestinians at this moment. The pressure only builds.
Well, the pressure in terms of words is building, but all of these countries, the United States, France, Britain, Germany, have the power to have a more immediate impact to stop the war in Gaza by withholding aid to Israel. But until now, what we've seen is they've expressed concern about famine in Gaza. They've expressed concern about the inability to get aid into Gaza, but they're actually not doing anything to change the course of Israel's offensive in Gaza, which has now left at least 33,000 people dead, widely believed 70% of them are women and children. Until they stop talking about concern and actually do something to stop Israel from conducting this war, it's going to go on. And it doesn't appear that there is the political will to actually do that at the moment. Julia?
Yeah, they're not mutually exclusive. War, the hostage crisis, the humanitarian crisis. But as far as allies and foes alike, they're seemingly being treated as such, at least for now. One wonders what it would take. Ben Weidman in Beirut there for us. Thank you. Now, the situation in the Middle East, just one agenda item for discussion during a phone call between the presidents of the United States and China Tuesday. It's the first time Joe Biden and Xi Jinping have spoken since their historic in-person summit in the United States last November. The war in Ukraine, North Korea, technology, trade tensions and TikTok were apparently also mentioned. Our senior White House correspondent Kayla Tausche joins us now. Kayla, I think above everything, the importance is this simply that this phone call happened. It was clearly an extensive and wide-ranging phone call, and it's the first point of contact that they've had since the physical meeting in November of last year.
It is, Julia. There were quite a few high-stakes topics discussed in that more than 90-minute phone conversation between the two leaders that the White House described as candid and constructive. Among some of those topics, you mentioned a few of them, tensions over Taiwan, the South China Sea, North Korea's nuclear program, as well as China's support of Russia's war in Ukraine, which the U.S. expressed continued displeasure toward. There was also quite a bit of discussion of economic competition in the White House's of it. They discussed China's unfair trade practices and specifically the ownership structure of TikTok, where Congress in the U.S. is currently weighing a law that would force TikTok or force the Chinese owner of TikTok to divest the company to new ownership. That still remains to be seen, but the White House has lent its support behind that bill so far. The White House says that Biden wanted to hold this call simply to check in with President Xi after their summit in November, during which the two leaders pledged to just pick up the phone and call each other much more often so that there are not any misunderstandings between the leaders of two of the most consequential nations in the world. I asked NSC spokesman John Kirby whether there was a particular catalyst. Why now? Why did this call need to happen today rather than last week or next week, for instance? And he said simply that enough progress had happened at the staff level that it was time for them to check in. We should note, though, Julia, that Secretary of the Treasury Janet Yellen is traveling to Beijing in the coming days. Secretary of State Antony Blinken will be traveling to China in the coming weeks. And as is customary, usually the president likes to get on the phone to telegraph what's going to be discussed so that the meetings on the ground are as constructive and productive as possible. Julia?
Yeah, I think it's a key point, the fact that the Treasury Secretary will be back in China, because she was there recently, I believe, as well, back in China this week. It also follows, of course, some of the most high-profile CEOs and business leaders from America that were in China last week as well, and we heard about the meeting that they had with them, with Xi Jinping as well. Do you think this is playing into it and it's helping on some level at least diffuse tensions or at least improve understanding between the two nations?
Potentially, but it's just a matter of time, Julia, until the Biden administration comes out with its next slate of hawkish proposals toward China. I mean, just last month, the Biden administration opened up a new inquiry into electric vehicles that are manufactured in China. There's an ongoing review of a wide-ranging tariff program that was put in place under President Trump. And China continues to be a talking point on the 2024 campaign trail, which is just heating up. And so while, yes, tensions may be diffused for now, usually there is no shortage of policy proposal rollouts that intensify things behind the scenes, Julia.
Yes, probably good to make the phone call now because it's only going to get tougher as we head towards the elections. Yes. Kayla, great to have you. Thank you. Okay, straight ahead. Tesla's Q1 deliveries hit the skids. A major problem for Elon Musk or merely a bump in the road? We'll ask Tesla analyst and bull Dan Ives. Plus, the chip giant that's arm in arm with the world's biggest AI players. The CEO of Arm Holdings will be here to discuss the future of AI and plenty more.
I'm Dr. Sanjay Gupta, CNN's chief medical correspondent. This week on Chasing Life.
Lately, we have been paying attention to a very different virus, bird flu, which is caused by the H5N1 virus. If you start to hear that it's circulating in pigs, that would be a concern.
That means I would go from sleeping with one eye open to one and a half eyes open. Yeah, that would make me very concerned.
Listen to Chasing Life, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to First Move, and to all our viewers in the US, UK and Latin America, we hope you're having a terrific Tuesday evening. And it's a wonderful Wednesday morning, of course, if you're just waking up with us in Asia. And it's another day of April showers on Wall Street in today's Money Move. Investors still trying to find their Q2 groove, with stocks falling sharply and bond yields also rising. That's happening as more investors question the Federal Reserve's rate cut path, with a June cut looking less and less likely due to strong economic data and, of course, stubborn inflation. Several Fed officials, however, saying Tuesday that they still expect cuts sometime this year. Thank goodness for that, or the markets would be significantly lower. Asia, however, finishing mostly higher, as you can see. Strong gains for the Hang Seng, up more than 2% Tuesday as traders returned from the Easter holiday weekend. We'll see what Wednesday brings. Xiaomi is a big winner there, up almost 9% on reports that orders for its new electric vehicle have been strong so far. And a less electrifying story for EV giant Tesla, Elon Musk's company, reporting its first drop in year-over-year sales since the pandemic. Tesla delivered 387,000 vehicles in the first 3 months of the year. That was well below expectations. And all this sent Tesla shares down 5% near in Tuesday's trade. Just to give you some perspective, shares have fallen more than 30% year to date, making Tesla, in fact, one of the worst performing stocks on the S&P 500. The first quarter was a rough one for China's biggest EV maker, BYD 2. Its sales fell 40% compared to Q4, making Tesla once again the world's largest EV maker. That context is crucial. Dan Ives is the managing director of Wedbush Securities, and you always have a great phrase on these things. You're calling Tesla's new numbers a, quote, train wreck, an unmitigated disaster. I think you called it a train wreck into a brick wall quarter, in fact. Dan, this was pretty painful.
I mean, look, it was a horror show in terms of 1Q. Now, look, everyone was expecting rip the Band-Aid off type of quarter. But, Julia, much worse than expected. I mean, this is a code red situation going on with Musk and Tesla, especially in China.
Talk to me about China, because you've said that you think, or at least estimate, that sales there were down around, what, 3% year over year?
Yeah, I mean, we were expecting it was going to be up 2-3%. You know, and if you go back, we've continued to cut numbers. Look, the problem is that competition increasing. You see EV demand that's softened, and it's a Game of Thrones price war. And that's why right now you need a pilot on the plane. And Musk, we've seen the last few conference calls, no adult in the room. This is a fork in the road period for Musk and Tesla. There's massive growth on the other side of this, but they need to get through this Category 5 storm. And I think today was a wake-up call.
You've called it a seminal moment, because what we're seeing is price cuts to try and shift these products. We're seeing increasing competition, but the price cuts are creating margin compression, or at least pressure. Dan, what is the solution here? How do they get this car back on the road?
Well, first, you got to come out with the actual roadmap for the next, call it, year and a half in terms of new product, sub 30K car. But also, it's like, put a line in the sand. Either cut prices massively, squeeze the competition, and then put that strategy, or hold serve. Don't cut prices. Demand's going to be where it is, and ultimately, you at least keep margins. The problem for investors right now, Julie, is that you're playing a game of blindfolded dart. Mm. No strategy. That's the problem. At a time, investors need handholding.
Do you think the product's good enough, Dan, just to hold fire now on prices and say we are facing increasing competition, we've got the best product? Because that's crucial, too. If you're saying to customers, look, we're cutting prices, then next minute you come back and cut prices again, they're going to hang on in there and wait for further cuts. There's going to be a reticence to buy. And I think that also surely plays into this. The messaging matters.
It's just psychology, right? I mean, if you going back to the days you buy a TV 2 weeks later, 10% cheaper. Look, it comes down to 2 million vehicles they're going to deliver this year. I mean, they are the brand leader. But it goes back to, look how Cook and Apple got through periods, challenging periods. They didn't cut prices. So I think it shows for Musk, this is probably the toughest time in 4 or 5 years for Tesla. They need to navigate through this to get onto the other side. This was a Cinderella story the last few years, now turned into a horror show, at least in the near term.
What would you like to see him do? Do you have a view, Dan? I know you've said, look, I just want the game plan. I want to know what the plan is. Do you have a view on what the best plan for Tesla would be? And I guess my follow to that is, we know that the stock's already down by a third this year. I mean, we often talk and laugh about how bullish you've been now for the long term. And if we talk about the long term too, is this a buying opportunity? Do you give him the benefit of the doubt and assume that he will come up with a plan?
Yeah, look, we've been here before. I mean, you've talked about it for many years, right? So the point is, we are strong believers that this will just be another, I won't call it bum in the road, but a challenging period. Musk needs to commit to being CEO next 3 to 5 years, keeping the AI initiatives within Tesla, give the strategy on price cuts, margins, and guidance. And I think then at least you have a roadmap for investors to get through this. But that's what needs to happen. I also think a major buyback. You have $30 billion of cash, do a $5, $10 billion buyback announced, because that's what they need to do. But it goes back to Jensen, Cook, Nadella. They've been through challenging periods. It got them through it. That's what Musk now needs to do, not just talk, walk the walk.
Dr. Dan Ives giving his prescription for Tesla there. Always great to get your perspective. Managing Director at Wedbush Securities. Thank you, sir. Now, severe weather ripping through the eastern half of the United States. A new tornado watch has been issued for parts of Tennessee, Kentucky, Indiana, and Ohio. Forecasters are also warning people there of large hail and powerful wind gusts. Chad Meyer joins us now. Chad, you were talking to us about this yesterday. Clearly, you need to expand upon it. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, watches and warnings are significant in the United States, and we have over 1,000 tornadoes on the ground every year. That doesn't make them less dangerous. If you don't know the terms, grab an avocado, a couple peppers, some onions, and some salsa, and then you have a guacamole watch. Put them all together, and all of a sudden you have a guacamole warning. You've made it. All the ingredients have come together, and now you have a tornado that's on the ground. And that's what we talk about when we talk about the watch. Big areas for a long time, and then small areas for warnings in only 15 or sometimes 20 minutes, because that's all these tornadoes are on the ground for. But there has been damage. There will be more damage tonight, and these storms will go all the way through the evening and the night. And that's the problem, Julia. Some of these storms will be on the ground after people have gone to sleep. And so if you don't get the warning, you don't hear the alarm, you don't wake up, you don't get to your safe place, that's how we lose people. That's how the fatalities happen, especially in the South, southern part of the U.S., where most of these things happen after dark. Yes, we have a few tornadoes on the ground right now, without a doubt. One just moved over the interstate there, south of Jellicoe, in parts of Kentucky. But this is going to continue through the evening into the overnight hours. There may even be some thunderstorms across the East Coast into bigger cities here across the East Coast in the overnight. And yes, up here, that's not the wrong color. That is snow across parts of New England all the way back to Wisconsin. And it's the warm air we talked about yesterday, trying to say, hey, it's springtime, let me north. And the cold air saying, not so fast. I still want to be in charge. And that's the clash of the warm and cold, like shaking vinegar and oil. They don't want to mix. And that's why we get tornadoes here in the U.S.
Yeah. Chad Myers, great to get your perspective. Thank you for joining us. All right, coming up now on First Move, from courtroom trials and tribulations to campaign trails. Former President Donald Trump stumping in key swing states. We're live at one of his campaign events next. Welcome back to First Move with a look at more of the international headlines this hour. Turkish state media says a fire in Istanbul has killed at least 29 people. The blaze started during daytime repair work at a nightclub, with officials saying the victims were all construction workers. Local authorities have detained 8 people in connection with the fire, including the club's business manager, accountant, and partners. A 12-year-old in Finland allegedly killed one of his classmates and injured 2 others during a school shooting on Tuesday. State media says the suspect used a handgun license to a close relative. The child has been charged with murder and attempted murder. Police say they have no details about the motive. Ukrainian officials say a Russian missile attack on the city of Dnipro wounded at least 18 people, including 5 children. President Volodymyr Zelensky says a college and a kindergarten were damaged. The attack comes as additional U.S. aid remains tied up in the House of Representatives, where Republicans are divided over whether to continue funding Ukraine. And after weeks away from rallies, Donald Trump is now cramming in two. He's campaigning in key swing states, Michigan and Wisconsin, which, of course, he won in the presidential election back in 2016, but then lost in 2020. It's also been a fraught few weeks for the former president, whose legal woes continue to plague the campaign. Just after paying the $175 million bond in his civil fraud case, he got an expanded gag order imposed in the hush money trial. And now we're learning his legal team is once again trying to get the judge in that case to recuse himself due to his daughter's political ties. Kristen Holmes is at that campaign in Green Bay, Wisconsin, and he joins us now. And Kristen, I think, and I believe the former president's actually speaking, so you're going to have to compete with him in terms of volume with that speaker. What message can he give today in 2024 that manages and achieves the same result he got in 2016 and avoids the loss that he saw in 2020?
Well, right now they believe that messaging is all about immigration. Remember, immigration, his anti-immigration rhetoric carried him to the White House in 2016. It did not do anything in 2020. He didn't really campaign on that. Now in 2024, it is back on the forefront. It is an issue that most voters rank as their top issue. And Donald Trump is strong when it comes to this issue. So what you are hearing him do now is really double down on his rhetoric, linking immigrants and migrants to violent crime. I want to be very clear here. We have reported this over and over again. The data shows that migrants or immigrants are much less likely to commit crimes than citizens. However, there have been a number of high-profile recent cases that Donald Trump has really latched onto, stoking fear, saying he is the only person who can keep America safe. The other thing to point out here is just how critical the states of Wisconsin and Michigan are. Both the Biden campaign and the Trump campaign believe that these two states are necessary to make it back to the White House. One of the things that Donald Trump's team believes happened in 2016 here in Wisconsin, where he lost by a very small margin in 2020, was that after he had all the support in 2020, there was just fatigue after 4 years of Donald Trump in office. They are trying to re-energize his base, re-energize these Republicans who decided not to show up in 2020. And they believe that they can do that with this focused messaging on immigration and on the economy, but really tying all of it back to immigration, because they have seen that in various states, particularly in the primaries in New Hampshire, for example, it helps him win in elections, or at least it helps him win in those contests when he does focus so heavily on immigration.
Yes. Good job, Kristen. Thank you so much for that. We'll leave you and the former president speaking live there from Green Bay in Wisconsin. All right, we're going to take a break here on First Move, but coming up, you may not know it, but there's a strong chance that your phone, TV, or car contains technology from semiconductor and software firm Arm Holdings. Arm designed some of the world's most advanced chips, which are also in growing demand to power the AI wave. The CEO of Arm Holdings, up next.
I'm Ina Garten. Welcome to Be My Guest, the podcast. One of the best gifts you can give friends is spending time together. But what's even better than that? Cooking with them. On Be My Guest, the podcast, new friends and old stop by my barn for some conversation and great cooking. We talk about food, life, and everything in between. Listen to Be My Guest, the podcast with me, Ina Garten, and join us wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to First Move. Chip giant Arm Holdings may not create as much market buzz as artificial intelligence phenomenon NVIDIA, but perhaps it should. Arm says 70% of the world's population uses its products. Its chip technology is included in most smartphones, cars, across the Internet of Things and data centers. And of course, it's increasingly being used to power and help AI. Now, Arm is not a chip maker. It makes money by licensing its chip designs and technology to clients and partners like Google, Microsoft, Amazon and NVIDIA, just to name a few. And the licensing fees and payments from tech giants adds up. Arm recorded revenues of almost $3 billion last year. Now, a quarter of arms sales also come from China through an entity, an independent entity called Arm China, which is also one of the company's largest customers. Arm is based in the UK. It recently listed in the United States, though its biggest investor is Japan's SoftBank, and its stock is up more than 80% so far this year, on a par, in fact, with Nvidia's year-to-date gains. As you can see on this chart, its shares also spiked more than 30% just 2 months ago, after the firm raised its sales and profit guidance. And I'm very excited to say Arm Holding CEO Rene Haas joins us now. Rene, fantastic to have you on the show. I hope we did a relatively decent job of trying to simplify what your business is. But I think it's crucial to point out that it's a very sector diverse business, among many things.
Yeah, no, thank you, Julia. You did a great job of explaining what it is that we do. And I think the heart of it is that ARM technology is literally everywhere, and it's probably impossible to find a use case or someone on Earth who isn't using ARM technology in some way, shape, or form.
The beauty, I think, of what we're seeing today is that consumers in each of these markets, and I mentioned some of them, smartphones, autos, the Internet of Things, whatever it is, data centers, are all demanding more tools, more apps, more capabilities. I think we'd call it compute, or you'd call it compute or computing power. And then the adoption of AI just effectively puts that on steroids. Can you just describe sort of the growth that you're seeing as a result of your involvement in the AI sphere in particular?
Certainly. Well, so ARM has been around 30 plus years. And in those 30 plus years, nearly 300 billion chips in total have shipped with ARM technology. So as you said, they are in smartphones, whether it's your iPhone or your Android phone. We're in Ford F-150s, we're in Teslas, we're in PCs, we're in the data center. So we've had huge growth over our 30 years because everything has become a computer and everything is more and more intelligent. But now that AI, which on some level has been around for a number of years, has gone into a step function in terms of capabilities, we're seeing unprecedented demand for compute across everything that we see, all the markets I mentioned. And it's an amazing time because AI is going to unleash capabilities for society that we've never seen before. It's just amazing.
So in your 30-year history, this is truly something unprecedented.
I personally believe so. You know, as someone who grew up with Star Trek and 2001, A Space Odyssey, I never thought in my lifetime that we would see computers that could think, have context, make judgments. But that's what we're about to see. And it's going to have just an amazing amount of benefits for folks. You know, one of the examples I like to talk about is healthcare. When you think about going to the doctor's office and you think about the questions that are asked and the type of diagnosis that's done, a lot hasn't changed in 30, 40 years. Going forward, doctors will have your health history, your DNA, context of what you ate that night, what you ate the week before, and be able to prescribe and diagnose something that's very, very specific to you. That's just a micro example, Julia, but I think across the board, AI is going to unleash all of those type of opportunities for us.
Yeah, but I think it's important for people to understand how it affects them as an individual beyond, I think, what's the most obvious for many people today, which is sort of ChatGPT and the excitement that surrounded that. It's far more intrinsic, I think, to societal benefit going forward. We'll talk about the downsides in a second. You're partnered with just about every major player out there, Samsung, Apple, Qualcomm, Mercedes, Intel, Nvidia. Taiwan Semiconductor is another name. Some of these, they have perhaps deeper pockets, they have and could develop their own processors, some of the technology that you provide and license, particularly if they wanted to shore up the supply chains or increase their vertical integration. Rene, what stops them doing that? What's so unique about what you're doing today?
Yeah, thank you. It's a question that I get asked a lot, and it's one I really love to answer. Processors, which is what we do, is really hard. But what's much harder than doing the processor is the software that runs on the processor. So when you think about iOS on your iPhone, Android on your smart Android device, the operating system in your car, Windows running on a PC, all of those pieces of software and the millions of applications that have been written for them, they all run on ARM. Years and years, decades and decades of time has been spent optimizing these applications to run on ARM. That is huge, huge work and huge, huge investment that's just very, very hard to switch, which is why we have such a wide footprint across all the devices I mentioned. It's really not so much about the processor, more about the processor ecosystem, particularly the software.
And the architecture matters too. You mentioned in the beginning the number of chips that you've shipped. I saw 30 million plus developer hours in the first decade for the V9, which is part of the sort of chip architecture. And what you're saying is providing and fostering better performance, better security, which is sort of a flagship product, I think, that you guys are now pushing. Is it even possible for another developer to perhaps to catch up when we're talking about that many hours over that quantity of time?
I tend to look ahead rather than over my shoulder.
Yes.
I think it is going to be hard, as you stated. But, you know, going forward, one of the things that I think really benefits ARM is not only this broad software ecosystem, but what we're really all about is power efficiency, low power devices, running off batteries. When you think about sustainability, when you think about the energy on the world's planet, you need the most power efficient processors to do those workloads. Now, with the advent of AI, the great news, as I mentioned, AI is going to unleash all kinds of capabilities, all kinds of new experiences to enrich our lives. On the other hand, the amount of power that's required to run these data centers or run these devices is going to be immense. So power efficiency is going to be extremely important relative to AI. Happens to be an area that ARM is really good at, so we're really excited about that opportunity.
Yeah, efficiency. Essential to the growth that we're at least hoping to see. Can I ask about the Chinese business as well? I mentioned it's operated by a sort of independent entity. It was one of the things I think that came up in the prospectus when you were listing. And one of the quotes was, it's an entity that operates independently of us and is also our single largest customer. The relationship, of course, between the Chinese and the United States is increasingly contentious, I think, and not expected to improve, at least in the technology sphere, simply because I think both are fighting for supremacy and for prowess. How do you balance the relationship as you sit as, in many ways, a bridge between the two nations?
Yeah, I think one thing that myself and just about every major technology CEO thinks about now is geopolitics. And if you were to go back 5 years ago, I think even just a few years ago, the amount of energy that we spent and my brethren with folks in Beijing or in Washington or in Brussels is at a different level. And, you know, candidly, that's the world that we live in now. We now have to be much more mindful of the geopolitics, the issues that we face on the globe. I think what the world has also recognized, particularly, you know, post-COVID, is that semiconductors are really, really important. And as a result, whether it's myself or other CEOs in the semi world, we spend a lot of time with government officials trying to understand and make sure that we are navigating through all that, because it's a different game now for us.
Do you think it gets harder, irrespective of leadership positions and whoever wins the 2024 election? To your point, Renee, and I think it's an important one, everybody considers chips essential. It's going to be a huge fuel to growth and taking care of societies in the future in many different respects. I don't see the tensions improving. Or do you, as a tech CEO, see ways to perhaps circumvent those for the good of both nations?
You know, I'm an optimist by nature. I think a lot of technology advancements we were able to achieve when the Earth was a lot flatter than it seems to look right now. I tend to believe that the countries and companies need to work together to make sure that there are open standards, that we're collaborating together on all these techniques, particularly with AI, because it's going to be very, very crucial. But as you said, we do live in unpredictable times. So across the industry, we're going to have to navigate that.
And you have no choice. So you'll continue to do so. You are the CEO of ARM. You're also on the board of SoftBank, which many in my audience will understand, a giant investor, and has had sort of a roller coaster ride over the past few years as well, which is part of the format, I think, with the Vision Fund that they have. How did they and you, if you're wearing both those hats, view not only the impact of the future of artificial intelligence, but also on where the limits should be applied and perhaps swiftly for safety purposes?
Yeah, so SoftBank, as you mentioned, is our largest shareholder, and I do sit on the board of SoftBank. So as a result of that, a lot of dialogue with the SoftBank leadership, particularly Masa. It is an area that SoftBank and frankly all companies are trying to think about in terms of AI regulations, how to think about safety, how to think about standards. It's top of mind, whether it's SoftBank, whether it's Arm, frankly, across our partners. I attended a UK AI safety summit last fall, which put many countries together, many industry leaders, and maybe akin to the first time there was a discussion about climate change. It's almost on that level, where I think globally, countries and companies need to get together to think about how to navigate AI safely.
Yeah, I mean, the fact that it's being discussed at that level and by all nations at this moment, I think gives you a sense of the gravity. Hopefully we get regulation right on this, because the benefits, I think, are enormous. Renee, fantastic to chat to you. We'll continue the discussion, I hope. Renee Haas, the CEO of Arm Holdings. Great to chat to you, sir.
Now, thank you so much.
Thank you. If you've missed any of our interviews today, they will be on my X and Instagram pages. You can search for @JChatterleyCNN. All right, coming up next, the new face of women's basketball. We'll look at the rise of emerging superstar Caitlin Clark. Welcome back to First Move. American college basketball star Caitlin Clark gave a sensational performance Monday night. She and the rest of the Iowa Hawkeyes eliminated defending champions Louisiana State University from the Women's March Madness tournament. The showdown set an all-time ratings record for a women's college basketball game. Koi Wire has more.
On Monday, we witnessed arguably the most highly anticipated matchup of the college hoops season, an on-court rivalry centered around Iowa's Caitlin Clark and LSU's Angel Reese, drawing more than 12 million viewers just in the U.S. A rematch of last year's national title game, a pumped-up, sold-out crowd in Albany, and Clark was ready from the jump, hitting a three-pointer, of course, to open the scoring. This game was tied at 45 at halftime, and the pace was so fast, but Clark showed no signs of slowing down, hitting three after three. She hit nine of them in total from behind the arc, tying the NCAA women's record for most in a single tournament game, also breaking the record for most career threes in women's Division I hoops. Angel Reese dominant as well, dropping 17 points, 20 rebounds, but in the end, she'd foul out, and Iowa was able to crack the LSU code with their own cheat code. Caitlin Clark with another performance for the ages, a 94-87 win. Afterwards, both Reese and Clark talked about their very different experiences this time around.
I know our group has given everything we got, and at the end of the day, you win, you lose. I feel like our group has given so much to this game and to this program that you can always help hold your head high. But I think at the same time, that's the reason we have been able to play such good basketball, is we don't want this to end, and we want to keep coming back and working hard with each other and fighting for one more week and, extend it as long as you possibly can, I guess.
I'm still a human. Like, all this has happened since I won the national championship, and I said the other day, I haven't had peace since then. And it sucks, but I still wouldn't change. I wouldn't change anything, and I would still sit here and say, like, I'm unapologetically me. I'm going to always leave that mark and be who I am.
All right, Iowa get their revenge by eliminating Reese and LSU. They are into the Final Four, where they will now face the University of Connecticut on Friday. Caitlin Clark just two wins away from her first national title as she tries to end her historic collegiate career in style. Back to you.
Thanks to Koi Wire there. Felt for Angel Reese. I watched that press conference. She'll be back. Now, from rising stars to the biggest star in our solar system, the sun. It's going to be hard to find, though, in parts of North America on Monday next week as a solar eclipse briefly turns day into night. Canada's famous Niagara region is already declaring a state of emergency as tourists flock to witness the once-in-a-lifetime event. Paula Newton explores.
Niagara Falls is known for its stunning views. The number of people expected to visit the famous waterfalls may soon become a spectacle in itself. It's a prime viewing site for the solar eclipse on April 8th as it crosses North America, passing over Mexico, the United States, and Canada.
Even though we get 14 million people every year,
It's over the year. It's not all at one time. To get 1 million at one time would be by far the biggest crowd that we've ever had.
Canada's Niagara region has declared a state of emergency so that emergency services can prepare for the influx of people. Hotels, stores, and restaurants are gearing up for the visitors, which are estimated to outnumber the locals. Ontario's Niagara region has a population of nearly 500,000 people, but some business owners say they're looking forward to some extra company.
We're expecting to have a full house for the first time in a long time, right? We're coming up for the winter season, so it's an exciting time.
By the time the eclipse is fully visible over Niagara Falls at approximately 3:18 p.m. Eastern Time, it will be nearing the end of its trek across the continent, which happens when it passes over the coast of Newfoundland and Labrador. It will be the first total eclipse in Canada since 1979 and the last time the contiguous U.S. will see one until 2044. So it's a sight many people say they don't want to miss.
Having that collective feeling of, oh, the sun's gone, and you know, seeing something that's so rare and so beautiful, to see the stars come out in the day, yeah, it's something that my kids will remember their whole lives.
Paula Newton, CNN.
And you can join us next Monday for the total solar eclipse as it travels from Mexico across America and into Canada. Our special coverage starts at noon Eastern, 5 p.m. in London. And if you're going to be watching live, get the right goggles. That's all I'll say. And finally, on First Move, Forbes crowns a new crop of billionaires as it releases its latest rich list. It includes the debut of one Taylor Swift, the pop phenomenon whose ascent has been turbocharged by blockbuster albums and a record-breaking concert tour. It's also a first for a musician and recording artist, as the senior editor of Forbes, Chase Peterson-Withorn, explains.
There's more and more money to be made in music these days if you're at the top. You know, we've seen these huge sales of catalogs over recent years. And also, you know, the money you can make touring can be pretty substantial. But, you know, most celebrities who become billionaires, they have other business ventures. Kim Kardashian has Skims. Rihanna has Fenty. But Taylor Swift is the first person to do it just off of raking in money, touring, recording, and of course, famously re-recording her way to the billionaires list.
Pure music. And that just about wraps up the show. Thank you for joining us, and I'll see you tomorrow.